Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Lauren B. Wolfe. Lauren B. Wolfe is a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She graduated with a degree in poetry writing from the University of Pittsburgh, and her poems have appeared in Two Review and Pittsburgh City Paper. She was the sound engineer for Prosody in 2006 and 7. She is currently an MFA student at Kent State University in Ohio. Hi, Lauren. How are you?
I'm fine, Jan. How are you?
Good. It's good to see you on this side of the mic, and it's exciting to have you back. So,
well, thank you.
So you're going to read from Manuscript in Progress?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. I'm going to begin with some poems about a trip to Tibet that I took several years ago. Sky Burial. The way the funeral begins. Backs broken, bodies shrouded in white silk katas and carried from monastery to stone circle. Naked and powdered, fresh sampa whites their blue-gray skin. Prayer flags spin and dusty suede mountains hum. Vultures circle and sit, held back by men with sticks. They pace quicker and quicker, gnashing their beaks, jerking their talons, ready for the cutting. Men with machetes and steel hooks, a slice with the blade, then a hook, and a ripping back of flesh. The body brought to bones in minutes, milk white and loose. This is all we are, a hand with skin slipping from fingers. Meat piled atop rocks. Vultures run toward perfume of blood and skin, seize flesh from each other's beaks, and swallow the human whole. There's not enough bodies for everyone. It is a little gruesome, but the Tibetans cannot bury the dead or cremate them. So this is the next best thing, I suppose. Compromise, a Tibetan ballad. I've been plagued. Winds outside the mountain, circles spinning around clouds, silkscreen mesh covering the spinning of the wheels. I can see God in red robes holding a mala. Hands cover the eyelids, and walls of rock hide torture. I see shaved heads marching to a motherland I never heard of. I was born as amber, a raw pinch of pine. God looks at me from another country. I see God spinning divine wheels, distant Indian mountains block. Surely he must not forget to put my name on one bead. I twist a silent om. The backs of their heads don't look different, except no sweat from the dusty plateau. Monks sit across from me. We share the same color hair. My name is not meant for China. What holds us together? I find bones scattered outside a village of concrete huts, a dusty yak jaw, teeth still in place, some enamel bleached thin by the sun, chips off my finger as I grip the thing like a handle meant for steering solid rock. I have learned to love bones these many months spent here walking the Himalayas. Their stiff symmetry and smooth core has a history, a soul still locked inside. And when I find them and pick them off the dusty earth so high, they shake forbidden, they still sing. I want to bring that song to you. I pluck each tooth from the jaw, the skull too big to carry home, and wrap them in a red bandana, while the ground quivers, made heavy by the hurrying of wild yak that run across the barley field to the river. Like the hard-grounded Himalayas. If we never ask ourselves anything that pertains to us, we accept less than our expectations. I accept that you don't love. I expect that you won't love. If we were arrowheads buried beneath a glacier 21,000 feet in the sky, frozen to the rock, black, cold, icy on the outside, we would reach out for air in a mountain with no opening.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Lauren B. Wolfe. reading her poetry. These Himalayan poems, Tibetan poems, are really interesting and, you know, sort of a subject matter that you don't see that often in poetry. So I'm curious about a couple things here, content-wise, I guess. You said that the Tibetans can't bury their dead or cremate them. Why is that?
The ground is too hard in Tibet.
Okay.
It's too dense. It's all rock up there. And they don't have enough trees to cremate. It takes a lot of wood and heat to burn a body. So they dissect them, if you will, in this way and feed them to the birds because it's more economical. And they believe in reincarnation and they believe in the cycle of life. So they're giving back to nature in a way. So we were fortunate enough as a group, or not so fortunate enough, to witness one of these funerals and it had a profound impact. Mm-hmm. Something like that on the rest of your life. And of course, any kind of traveling makes for good poetry, mm-hmm. I think.
Well, when were you there?
In 2003. Mm-hmm. So that was several years ago, but I continue to work on the poems and generate material from that experience because it was so unlike just traveling to Europe or, mm-hmm. or someplace in the United States. And that was particularly why I chose to go there. I think as an undergraduate, they want you to study abroad in Europe or England. And I was like, well, I really want to write great poems. Where could I go? I'll go to Tibet. And it worked. My plan was successful, and I got a lot of good material out of it, and mm-hmm. that was my goal. So
you were there for a whole semester?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, I'm really struck by, you know, the sounds in your poems. You know, there's all this compression, and, you know, I have a couple lines here that I have, the body brought to bones in minutes, you know, those B sounds and, you know, there's a lot of bones so far anyway in your poetry and some really chilling statements like there are not enough bones for everyone. I've learned to love bones. Okay, so it does get a little, as you said, it sounds gruesome, but if you think of it in context, it's very different. But
Yes, and I did a research project over there on human bone carving, because historically the Tibetan monks would carve human bones for Buddhist ritualistic purposes, and I spent the last month there doing a research project on that. So I became very fascinated with this idea that there's still energy left in bones once the person is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe that, so I was studying it, and so of course, you know, you start to think about the body in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the context for those poems comes from, that experience.
Mm-hmm.
But lyrically, I definitely think it's important. You know, people talk about the difference between, you know, lyric poetry and narrative poetry, but I think all poetry is inherently lyrical in some way. You should constantly be thinking about the sounds that you're creating. That's essential to what makes a poem different from prose. So,
although there's a lot of prose with great
right.
sound and a lyrical sense
and
also.
Oh, there definitely is. And even now in my courses, and the fiction writers want to know how they can do those things better. And mm-hmm. it's easier for me to explain to them that kind of stuff than mm-hmm. plot and
setting.
Yeah. I can help you with your sounds.
All right. Okay, can you read more poems?
Sure. I'm going to read a couple. Besides writing about traveling and different worldly experiences, of course, all poets are trying to understand their world. So relationships, you know, are a big catalyst for content. This is called Arrowheads and Hatchets. 1. Sitting on a tree stump, a rubber mat beneath his feet, James cuts deep into the rock. A mound of shards left behind bury his feet. Obsidian is in his left palm, elbow tight against the knee. The right hand cradles the antler bone used to dig hard into the stone's edge. He pulls up and away with his left wrist, leaving a cleave in the volcanic glass. a rough-ledged point that will pierce anything it flies straight through. 2. He's asleep now, folded on the couch, a downward bend right in the middle. His head tilts to the side, and black curls of hair hang over the edge of his neck. The divot of his back, where those broad shoulders have tucked in close, hugging the stone all day, are strong even at rest. He dreams of running barefoot somewhere in Utah, the cacti nipping at his heels and his leather side pouch brought forth from the swaying of the hips. Bleached crystals collected inside and bits of turtle shells. He is chasing the red barrel of Topaz Mountain, and he whispers, "I never want to leave this desert." Behind him, it is handsome, between the shoulder blades, the divot of his back, like a canyon flowing up the spine. His shoulders are drawn down from the ears, elbows resting on thighs. He's bent over, looking at onyx float in his palm. I'm trying to admire him. I want to wade a minute in his fine, sharp line and watch his muscles undulate over bone. Stroke skin that hasn't been scratched from sifting through stones, grinding wood all day. I want to touch it, tender like suede. He cannot see the beauty that is behind him all day, the way it calls out to be touched, lightly by the sun, or by my hand coming closer near the edge of where his arms rise up slowly and cover me like a dark wave. I spent many years in a relationship with a boy that was a stone napper, so a lot of my poetry has rocks in it. And gems. And that comes from having them around the house just all the time and getting to learn which ones were which and watching him work with them. And these are the type of things that you write about, and then you realize when you put all these poems together that, wow, you know, I have these things that are running through them. And that's very fascinating. It's very interesting. Self-discovery almost. This is a little darker side. Of relationships.
Are we moving from the light now? Okay.
Those are kind of love poems, if I'm capable of such. What I forget. I laid around all day Sunday. He curled his fist into a ball. Drenched in sweat, I held still. The bedroom lit in peaking sun. I waited for a return, like kissing back. The bed empty, he punched a wall. If only you were more beautiful. He swore at the roof until the house collapsed. I rode the bus all evening past the same house. He chiseled rock in the basement until 3 a.m. The bruises healed from lack of touch. The bed tilted on its side. It was that forgiving. I remember his footsteps on the concrete, the black handprints painted on the walls. His index finger pushed up the tip of my nose. How 1/16th of an inch made all the difference. He claimed the fault was mine, a flaw in the system. I smiled sideways for days, wore earplugs at night. The wall provoked him again, a bigger hole. His fever percolated, the blankets in pieces. I blamed it on no love when there was more. He let ashes overflow in the sink. The door begged me to open it, run. I waited all day for a sorry that never came. Along those same lines, sort of. I've been writing about volcanoes lately, so this is called Premature Evacuation. Predicting an eruption that doesn't happen is unforgivable. It has been known to cause serious panic. 4th of July hauled it all away, the key on the coffee table, left behind bongo drums and love seat. 4:10 in the afternoon and it's raining stones. Pumice and obsidian fall from the sky. It's more than a mountain letting off steam. Another tectonic phenomenon. Not thinking twice, he settles on the back of the neck, desk in the trunk, clothes in black garbage bags, rocks on your pillow. There were precursors, tiny earthquakes for days, magnetic field disturbances, gravitational shifts. The bent fist in the air, words like stupid, and laughing in public not allowed. After the first eruption, a mere throat clearing, the still steaming summit gives way. Take the back roads without hardly hitting the brakes, and no one has to see you. It's not unusual for magma to rise and then stop. It takes decades for lava to build up in the chamber and bubble to the crater. Maybe I'll be luckier than I was before. He was grinding at me, pushing my plates together, then pulling them quickly apart.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Lauren B. Wolfe, reading her poetry. I want to ask you about sort of like the way the body is regarded in your work, because I kept hearing it over and over again, this body as object almost, you know, body as landscape. You know, for example, when you're talking in the poem, when you're talking about the divot of his back, you know, the canyon of his body, I mean, it seems like you're merging land and body a lot. And that coupled with the sort of the matter-of-fact voice that you use when you're talking about very difficult things or even the cutting, back to the cutting of bones. Is there some kind of connection between, you know, your experience in Tibet and how you regard the body or how you talk about the body in your poetry?
I think that there probably is. I think that we're trying to make sense of our world, and the body is very much a landscape that we travel. Especially when you're in a relationship, you're constantly, you know, exploring each other's bodies and each other's worlds and how your partner's body relates to their world. So the metaphors work in that way. Like, if you're a nature person, then I'm going to see your body as this landscape. And we were very, I'm very immersed in nature constantly. I enjoy it. And so I think of the body in that way, mm-hmm. sort of like a mountain or a river. Mm-hmm. That you're sort of trying to navigate almost. Mm-hmm. And it kind of is an object in some ways, coming from the things that I experienced or the things that I saw overseas. It is sometimes just, you know, a cavity, kind of. Mm-hmm. What's inside of it is different, but the outside is mm-hmm. just this thing that we hold everything inside of. Mm-hmm. And I guess you're constantly searching for the inside, but you have to go through the outside to get there.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, when you said, I'm going to talk about some relationship issues now, and then you said the poem is called Arrowheads and Hatchets, it was like frightening because... because of the bone poems you had just written. I mean, you know, there is a chilling nature to some of what you're writing.
Right. I think that the disturbing and the chilling help me to grow. And I hope that my reader is disturbed and chilled sometimes, because I think the uncomfortable helps us to understand our own humanity. And I think that that's what poetry is supposed to do. And a little discomfort is good for the spirit, because mm-hmm. it helps you evolve. Mm-hmm. And if poetry isn't helping you evolve, why are we writing it? Essentially, I mean, that's
okay,
what I'm
thinking. I'm still scared of your poems.
Well, sometimes I do it on purpose. I didn't realize that I had that effect until I read it a reading as an undergraduate, and the audience kind of just wasn't sure if they should clap. And I'm like, maybe I scare people. Maybe I should scare people more. Maybe they need to be scared.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And on a serious level, I mean, I think there's just wonderful, wonderful craft in there, and wonderful moments of that evoke some kind of response that I imagine could evoke a response in the reader or listener, as in, oh, what, you know, what am I supposed to think now? And what does that mean? And it's a stopping thing that I think is really interesting. And I think you're right. It will evoke and provoke thought and discomfort. And that is necessary. Okay. What else do you have there?
Yeah. You also write about your family, too, you know, so... all these great, wonderful things that you have as a poet that you have access to from life that you could pull out and create content. So this is called Adoption Day. Against the hard brown courthouse pew, my real mother pushed her hands into her purse, scooped out a silver compact mirror. She laid it in my small outstretched hands. I kept turning it over, rubbed its engravings against my palm like a gift that lets you know you are somebody. I flipped the lid open and shut, but never once heard it click, lock tight. Played with my face in the mirror, scrunched up my nose, pulled my lips apart, stuck out my tongue. I watched my reflection grow smaller the farther I held it away from me until I could see the two of us. Mother sat there, head cocked to the side with the deep stare of not listening, set permanently in her eyes. Cheeks sunken, skin brittle to the touch. I pulled the compact close so I could look straight in the mirror until it was no longer her face I could see. Habits of being frail. The stench of unwanted motherhood fills the kitchen like her USA Gold cigarette smoke, pot roast, and mashed potatoes. In one arm, the baby is asleep, her face tucked inside of fleece, a tiny blanket no thicker than a napkin. In the other hand, she holds a fork. Unable to hold up on her own, she is so hungry she cannot put the baby down. The fork, a pendulum swinging from her fingers, hypnotizing the beef on her plate. Her eyes, pale ginger, move with the gradual swaying, but never lift from the food. Hunched over, her hair hangs uncombed in all directions around her eyes, drawn down from the fierce fluorescent lights of the glossy blue kitchen. She cries for days, sometimes weeks. Her body forms rituals, feeding at her swollen breast, crying far away from where she can hear, and breathing in and out without her. Her fists clenched in a ball and eyes widen more. Her mother sleeps and sleeps, does not know how to console her, carry on, be alone. Everything returns to the womb, eats one another, is absorbed on the lips. They didn't use a straitjacket this time. This girl let her mind play hopscotch all day long. She twirled gum around her finger and tried blocking out the sun. She never moved on to harder games. On the playground all day, she watched her pebble skip over and over the white square blocks, dreamt her arms were made of silly putty. All the other children mistook her for an octopus and cried for their mothers. She tripped and fell. The pebble left a shadow on the ground. They came for her in an ambulance and wheeled her away. Now there are three walls, shrapnel on the floor, a big black stain on a gray-gray world. Her eyes are bulging out of their sockets. She is without her pebble and has to look herself straight in the eye.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Lauren B. Wolfe, reading her work. You know, throughout all these poems, there seems to me this sustaining sense of ritual through everything. You know, I mean, in the one of the mother poems, you talk about the ritual of what is happening with feeding and breastfeeding and the mother, the way things are done, seems to be something that runs through all of your poems. Is that something that you're conscious of in your writing to sustain this idea of ritual, or something that just comes up?
I think it's something that I am conscious of. I look at the world and I think a poet's struggle is trying to be honest and true when it comes to accuracy. Like, you want to say this is exactly how it happened. And a lot of things that happen in life are ritualistic. Mm-hmm. And when you're going to the page, you want to portray those things exactly how they happen. And then the challenge comes for me when you're writing, you can't always be literally true. You can't paint the picture exactly the way it happened. So you have to fill in the gaps and struggle with that a little bit. But
what's the conflict there for you? I mean, are you...
Attachment. attachment to what really happened versus how can I make this a good poem. And I think as you evolve as a writer, you let go of that attachment. A lot of young writers in my graduate program are like, I want to write about my family, but I can't. And I'm like, you have to let it go. You have to think about the poem too, and not necessarily how it exactly happened.
Right, exactly. But it's kind of ironic to hear you talk about attachment when you have this distant, chilling voice in a lot of your poems. Even with the family poems, there's a distance in the voice, which I think makes the poems work very well. There's a reporting voice.
Yeah, I don't think of my voice as being attached, but when I'm sitting down to write, I'm attached to what I remember.
Okay.
And you have to let that go.
Okay.
So that you can create the art.
That makes sense. Okay. We have time for another poem.
All right. I'm going to read something that's slightly... I want to read something that is a little less chilling. I also have a great sense of humor, and I've been trying to incorporate that more in my work because I don't want people to have the wrong impression, I suppose. Explorers located original comfort zone. All the team had as lead was a scent. They knew it smelled like honey and cloves, and when the eastern wind swept through, there was a hint of fennel. They went tracking in the Himalayas for weeks. The Sherpa guides tiptoed around the mountain where the Hindu mystic Garuda predicted she might be. It was one mountain out of millions. They were careful not to agitate any rocks, but around the bend there was nothing. They were getting tired of this mountain, the cold campground and breakfast of yak cheese and butter tea. The head explorer read a report from the States that calculated a snowball's chance in hell to be 0.0000134%. This was discouraging. They built a fire, tried to sleep, but the sky was bright with bold stars that weaved and whipped across the sky. When their eyes fell from the heavens, there she was, right by the river, sitting next to a small cave. Yellow and shaped like a circle, her heat penetrated their eyes, and they wept and cheered. But no one, not a single one, was man enough to walk up to her. All right, so maybe that wasn't entirely funny, but there's some lines in there, tone, speaking of the type of tone that I create, that are definitely humorous. So that's a leap for me.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We're out of time. Thanks for being here, Lauren.
Well, thank you, Jan, for having me.
It was fun. The poetry of Lauren B. Wolfe. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Sound engineers are Amy Sutton and Ziggy Edwards. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.